Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Clean Energy and Environmental Sustainability Initiative. Our speaker is California Institute of Technology Professor Dr. Nathan Lewis. Professor Lewis's lecture is titled, Where in the World Will Our Energy Come From? We begin with an introduction by Ken Luchin, Dean of the Boston University College of Engineering.
Today's speaker is Dr. Nathan Lewis. He is the George L. Argros Professor of Chemistry, and he has been on the faculty at Caltech since 1988 and has served as professor since 1991. He has served as the principal investigator of the Beckman Institute Molecular Materials Resource Center at Caltech since 1992. From 81 to 86, he was on the faculty at Stanford as an assistant professor. From 81 to 85, a tenured associate professor. From 86 to 88. Dr. Lewis received his PhD in chemistry from MIT, and his research interests include renewable energy, solar fuels, clean energy technologies, chemical vapor sensing using electronic noise, and artificial photosynthesis. Dr. Lewis has been an Alfred P. Sloan Fellow, a Camille and Henry Dreyfuss Teaching Scholar, and a Presidential Young Investigator. He received the Fresnius Award in 1990, the ACS Award in Pure Chemistry in 1991, the Orton Memorial Lecture Award in 2003, the Princeton Environmental Award in 2003, and the Michael Faraday Medal of the Royal Society of Electrochemistry in 2008. He currently is the editor-in-chief of the Royal Society of Chemistry journal, Energy and Environmental Science. He has published over 300 papers and has supervised approximately 60 graduate students and postdoc associates. I've met him yesterday and found out three other claims to fame. He is a close friend of Tom Friedman, well known for his books on energy, The Flat Earth and Flat Hot and Crowded, and a spectacular advocate for America moving forward in energy and its impact on reducing climate change. He is the PI on one of only three, approximately, if you cross your fingers, $125 million energy hubs funded by the Department of Energy, his hub focusing on fuel from sunlight, a spectacular challenge that could revolutionize the availability of energy using sun. And, most important perhaps, at Caltech, he is apparently a legendary chemistry teacher, with virtually every graduate from Caltech in the last 23 years, is that right, having been taught by Nate Lewis. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Nate Lewis.
I'm going to give you a little bit of the shorter version of this talk, but that's not to say that the longer version isn't worth it. If you want to go to see it, just go to my website, which is my initials, nutcaltech.edu. You can see a streaming video version of it. The environmental groups have caught on to it. I go into Starbucks half the time and see myself. It's great. And for the people listening on the radio, if you actually wanted to follow along to the slides, then you should just go to that link right now and find the energy presentation, and you can probably see it. I'm going to tell you three little stories. One is about the size of the energy problem, because you can't solve a problem until you understand how big it is. And we always hear in units that I think are meant to ensure nobody can understand this problem, how many kilowatt hours of electricity and short tons of coal and cubic feet of natural gas and on and on and on. I'm going to tell you how big the problem really is in units that everybody can understand. I'm then going to tell you why this is a real problem. Maybe we'll run out of oil. Maybe we've already run out of air in which to put it all. Which is going to hit us first and why? And then if you buy into those things as really being a problem, then I'm going to tell you about the laws of physics and chemistry as opposed to the laws of politics that tell you where the allowed solutions are. These are indisputable numbers that I think everybody on our planet should know. Rick Smalley, inventor of nanotechnology, said energy was the most important problem facing humanity today. Nobel laureate testifying in Congress. Trade Journal saying it. My friend Tom Friedman says it all over the book Hot, Flat, and Crowded, which I commend to you. A, because Tom's a friend, and B, because I'm all over quoted in the book, so I'm happy about that. And presidents of MIT are saying it. Every major university is starting programs now in energy and sustainability. That's because it's not solved. It is not true that we have all the technology we need. We only need the political will. You do need political will, but we also need to understand that this is a challenge for science and engineering to bring affordable clean energy to global scale in the time that we have left to do it. Here are the units that I think everybody can understand. That's watts. These are thermal watts, and we need to get the scale of energy right on that scale. A laptop is a few watts on average. Actually, iPods are about a few watts, iPhones. 1,000 of them is a toaster. That's a kilowatt. Don't leave your toaster on very long. That's your total average home electricity load. My wife thinks it's my big screen TV, but I know it's her toaster that's the real problem. 1,000 flying toasters is a megawatt. That's a small jet engine. 1,000 jet engines is a typically output in electricity watts of a nuclear power plant, a gigawatt, a billion watts. And 1,000 of those is the typical electricity load of the world, is a trillion watts. Now, you can see a lot more in this picture, which is now shown all over the place. You can see the 2 billion people that live on less than $2 a day in dire poverty. And the only way to get them out of that is to get them modern energy services. Because when you only have one candle to burn at night, you can't go for very long until the candle goes out before you can't study, before you can't get food, before you can't cure your diseases. And you can't cure almost any of the top 10 world problems unless you bring people clean, safe, reliable energy. But even this trillion watts, don't be fooled, is often quoted and mixed up, electricity and energy, but electricity is only a fraction of total energy demand. That doesn't account for all the energy needed to move our cars, to fly our planes, to heat our homes, and to make our products. Let's add all that up. If you take the total amount of energy consumed in the average year in joules, divide by the number of seconds in a year, you can get the total energy consumption rate on our planet by humans. And in watts, that's not a trillion watts, it's 13 trillion watts. In 2001, we're doing even better. We're pushing 15 trillion watts now. So that's what the average world's energy meter would read every second on average you looked at it right now. You can't solve the energy problem unless you devise solutions that aren't just a few light bulbs in Brookline, but that are 15 trillion watts. That's the problem the laws of physics say we have to solve. 85% of that now comes from fossil energy, oil, coal, and gas. A little bit comes from hydro. 10% now comes from biomass. But don't be fooled, this is all unsustainably burnt, where we're deforesting and decropping at a rate much more quickly than we replant it. The total amount of renewable biomass is in the total renewables column, 2/10 out of 15 now, and nuclear produces 0.9. Now, the astute amongst you will know we only make 0.3 terawatts of electricity because this is the heat produced by fission of the nuclei. In a nuclear reactor, only 30% of that makes electricity. In the same way that this is the heat produced by burning coal, 3 terawatts, only a third of that makes electricity. This is on a fair footing. All the heat content of all the primary energy consumed by humans in an average year. Okay. Maybe we'll run out. Maybe this landscape will just change because we're going to run out of fossil energy and then the market will fix this problem and scientists don't have to do anything. Well, you'll be waiting quite a while. These are peer-reviewed numbers, common consensus numbers, adding up all the conventional and unconventional reserves and dividing by consumption in a representative recent year. And you can see that we have between 40 and 80 years worth of proven reserves of oil on our planet, between 60 and 160 years of natural gas, and almost 200 years of coal. Now, some people look at this and say, that means we're going to run out of oil in 40 years. But the ratio of proven reserves to consumption of oil has been 40 years for the past 100 years, since the day after oil was discovered. The reason for this is that when it costs today $1 million a day to drill a well in the Gulf of Mexico, and still only one in every four wells hits oil and the other three are dry, It doesn't make sense to prove out 100 years of reserves and leave it in the ground. It only makes sense to explore and prove out 40 years' worth of reserves. And since discovery never stops, what matters more is the resource base, what the USGS estimates there is to be had by humans on our planet, because we will go get it all if the other choice is turning out the lights. We have between 50 and 150 years' worth of oil, between 200 and 600 years of gas, and happy days are here again, almost 2,000 years of coal. And furthermore, if oil peaks, when that happens, we already know how to convert gas and coal into liquid hydrocarbons. Germany did that on a dime when denied oil by the Allies in World War II. South Africa does that today when denied oil from the apartheid boycotts. And so we've got plenty of fossil energy, and this doesn't include the methane hydrates, the methane ices off the continental shelves, of which there is estimated to be more than all the oil, coal, and gas on our planet combined. The Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. And the fossil energy age is not going to run out anytime soon because we run out of fossil energy. That is not the problem. So don't worry. Just go home and feel good. Well, there's one little problem. You have to be careful what you wish for. You might get it. There's an important paper written in 1998 by Marty Hoffert and climate warrior Stephen Schwartz that we sadly just lost tragically. That's a summary of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's 1992 report. It's almost 20 years ago, but this paper is not about climate. It's all about energy. And I need to summarize it for you to understand just how big the situation really is. And what they said was, they actually analyzed what is involved in the so-called business as usual, end quote, scenario that everybody always assumes is the baseline. But that doesn't mean business by anybody's usual. What does it mean? Let's look at my favorite out year, 2050. My favorite out year is 2050 for two reasons. One, I teach historically. As I get older, my college freshmen don't. They're still 18. Now it will turn out when they're my age, that's 2050. This is our problem, not somebody else's problem. Number two is, unlike the internet, when you can have two Google boys and 3 years later they're a $1 billion company, energy doesn't work that way. When you put up a nuclear power plant, it's got to last for 40 years to pay itself back. Same thing for a wind farm, same thing for solar panels, same thing for a coal-fired power plant. So we are going to be building in the next 10 years pretty much the inventions needed and the energy technology that will dictate what our planet's going to look like in 2050. This is not 40 years away. It is our problem now. Well, people consume energy, and projections in business as usual are pretty much consensus. We're going to go from 6 billion people to 9 or 10 billion people. Call it 9, it doesn't matter. And then we need to think about services, because if after all we didn't do anything, if I didn't fly here, if we all lived in caves, if we didn't have this building to heat, we wouldn't necessarily use much energy per person. But GDP growth has globally been on average 1.5% per year, 1.6% for a century. And so this business as usual just projected we'd continue global economic growth at near recession levels, 1.6% per year for the next 50 years. Now, of course, nobody could have foreseen then the sustained double-digit growth of China and India. The developed countries believe that 4% is their target for sustainability. As we've seen painfully today, no country has a policy against economic growth. So it's unlikely this number will go negative, and if it's just bigger, it just makes the situation worse. These two things by themselves in this scenario would lead unmitigated, because of the magic of compound exponentials, to a tripling of energy demand within our lifetimes to 50 trillion watts. Now, it's not that bleak, because we save energy per unit of services produced of GDP. And we've been saving energy globally at a rate of 1% per year. And so under business as usual, the IPCC said, we'll embed that as an assumption that we'll continue to do in the future. And if you do that, then the math shows that you could hold energy to double. Now, I need to explain for you just how hard this will be. again to the magic of compound interest, it would bring us down to this red horizontal line. Within our lifetimes is the average energy consumption of a human on our planet of 2 kilowatts per person. We consume in the United States right now 10 kilowatts per person. The most energy advanced countries, the EU, Switzerland, and Japan, consume 3.5 kilowatts per person. If you drove a car half an hour today, that would be all the energy you could get in this budget. You couldn't eat. You couldn't turn on a computer. You couldn't heat your home. That's what 2 kilowatts on average for 24 hours is. So the projection is we'll save so much energy down to 2 kilowatts per person as built into business as usual. And if we do better than that, nothing I'm going to tell you about is going to change. If you want to hear the longer version of this talk, I can calibrate you, but quickly I'll just tell you what this really means. Humans are 100-watt light bulbs, because if you take a 2,000 food calorie a day diet, you divide by the number of seconds in a day, you can see we are just 100-watt machines. We're glowing all the time at 100 watts. I gave you 2 kilowatts. That doesn't sound bad. But the energy embedded in food, the energy needed to grow the food, to harvest the food, to process the food, to get it to the supermarket, to have you to go get it, put it in your refrigerator, is between 10 and 25 times the energy in the food itself. Don't even think about Mediterranean olives at Trader Joe's. I mean, right? Really bad on this basis. If you can hold it to 10, if, then just to eat your 100 watts means you burden the system with 1 kilowatt, and I'm going to give you 2. Let's assume we save energy down to twice the level it takes to eat. Then you could hold energy demand to double, to 25 terawatts. That's business as usual. And if we got better than that, and we held energy down to what it takes to eat, and held energy demand flat, something the world has never done in human history, nothing I'll tell you about will change. Because we got plenty of fossil fuel to support this demand growth, and no region of the world is now doing anything other than increasing its consumption of fossil energy. China is putting on coal like it ain't going out of style, because it ain't. Well, we need to know one more fact. This is the amount of carbon emitted to the atmosphere per unit of energy consumed. Again, these are historical data. And we started out just being bad engineers, because cavemen heating themselves by burning wood, most of the energy goes out to the air as CO2, and hardly any goes to the cave person and to heat the cave. Then we got better. In the 1900s, we just became bad chemists, because we used a lot of coal, and coal by mass is all carbon, and so when you burn it, all the energy is released as making CO2 into the atmosphere. And now we're better, because natural gas is CH4. When you burn one molecule of CH4, you make one molecule of CO2, but you make 2 molecules of water, H2O. So more of the energy comes out as water, and less is associated with making CO2. And oil is in between, because its chemical formula is in between. Those three numbers we can do nothing about. They are fundamental properties of the heats of combustion of oil, gas, and coal. Now, we were in the middle in 1990, and we had been trending downwards, and the IPCC said, under business as usual, well, we think the next 50 years will continue the trend that the last 100 years showed. Now, the quick observers will see that this brings the average down below the least carbon-intensive fossil fuel, natural gas. The only way you can get the average lower than any of the individual values is to have a zero somewhere in the arithmetic. Furthermore, to the extent that we just don't use natural gas and shut off all the coal and oil consumption on our planet, and we have roughly equal parts oil, coal, and gas, you need even more zero to get it to add up. This is embedded in business as usual. Now, I'm not going to tell you quite yet just how much you need to stay on this path, but I'll assume we do this too. So in addition to saving energy down to twice what it takes to eat, we'll assume that we continue to decarbonize the energy mix to better than a pure natural gas economy within our lifetimes. Well, if you know the amount of energy consumed in each year, and you know the amount of carbon emitted per unit of energy consumed in each year, it is just arithmetic to multiply those two things together to get how much CO2 will absolutely, no questions asked, go into our air. The significance of that is it brings us on to this top curve. And that top curve, saving energy down to twice what it takes to eat, and near recession level economic growth, is not even close to what it would take to hold carbon dioxide levels to even double 550 parts per million what any human would have otherwise experienced. If you wanted to hold it at 350 parts per million, you have to follow this bottom curve. When people held up those signs and said 350, the only physical way to do that is to never burn a drop of oil, coal, or gas again on our planets within our lifetimes. That's what the laws of physics say you have to do. Now, we do not know absolutely which level of CO2 in the air compared to the 280 parts per million that were stable for 10,000 years on our planet is, quote, safe, end quote. There are at least six major climate models, and they differ from each other. Therefore, we know that at least five must be wrong. The only proven date at which a scientist can say we will know what the climate is like in 2050 is on January 1st, 2050, when you open your door and look outside. This is absolutely not about waiting for sound science. This is absolutely all about risk management in an experiment with our planet that we get to do or not exactly once. We know that CO2 levels have been between 200 and 300 parts per million for 450,000 straight years, now extended to 670,000 straight years. We know that 1, 2, 3, 4, now 7 times that changes of 100 parts per million of CO2 have been highly correlated with, but not necessarily proven to be the causes of, temperature changes that have sent us into and out of ice ages. And we know that within our lifetime, that absolutely CO2 levels will be off this chart. We don't know for sure what this will bring. It just depends how lucky you feel. Our inability to predict is the real issue here. We know essentially every glacier is melting at accelerating rates. We know the actual observed rates of melting are faster than the most pessimistic models predicted because we don't understand how it lubricates underneath the ice. No matter what you think about the radiative effects of CO2 in the air, everybody that's ever opened a can of soda knows that by the laws of chemistry, when you add CO2 to water, you make it acidic. The pH of the oceans is now lower than it's been in 4 million years and probably in 20 million years. Most, but not all, climate models say that although 20% of the coral is bleached today, that 95% of it will be bleached within our lifetimes. The last time this occurred, it took only 2 million years for the pH of the oceans to recover. If you believe the climate models, then the only place our kids will see colored coral is in an old movie called Finding Nemo. This doesn't account for the nonlinear effects that the permafrost is melting, and when it melts, that ice that was reflecting light now reveals more dark soil that absorbs it, that then absorbs more sunlight, that releases more methane and permafrost and CO2. There is enough here that if it continues to melt, that CO2 levels wouldn't go up by a factor of 2, they could go up by a factor of 10. This did happen once before on our planet, at least 230 million years ago in the Permian era, when there was an isotopically light, massive release of CO2. We know that temperature spiked 6 degrees on average centigrade, 12 at the poles. We know the fossil record shows that 90% of the species then on Earth could not adapt and went extinct. We absolutely do not know if or when this would happen again. None of these predictions are in any climate model because this is outside of a world humans have ever experienced. we do know that there is only one way to find out. How long does this last? CO2 is the most oxidized form of carbon in the oxidizing atmosphere in which we live and breathe oxygen. It's what you get when you burn a candle. There's no natural destruction mechanism of it. It is not like ozone that is made and destroyed. When it goes into the air, roughly half of it goes into the plants and into the oceans. What happens to the other half? Well, it's got to mix water from the thermocline near surface oceans through that gradient to the deep oceans. Best scientific knowledge says, and we do know a lot about this mixing, that if we kick the habit in 40 years, that CO2 levels would come down 3/4 of the way in 500 years, and the remaining quarter back to the Earth we live on now in 10,000 years. For an average recovery time to the planet that we now live on of 3,000 years. And nobody has a technically credible way of removing the almost 600 trillion pounds of CO2 that will be in our air by then. If you do, don't tell me. Just enter the Earth Challenge and Richard Branson will give you $25 million on the spot. This is simply the biggest experiment with the chemistry of the atmosphere of our planet that humans will ever do. Embedded in business as usual, to get the average down there, assuming we save energy down to twice the level it takes to eat, was 10 trillion watts of carbon-free power. And that doesn't hold CO2 levels to double. If you want to hold it to double, you need 20 trillion watts. If you want to do better than that, you need better than that. If you don't save energy down to twice what it takes to eat, you need better than that. By any measure, the real challenge is we need to find a way to bring online as much clean energy, starting today, as all the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear power on our planet combined. And if you wait 40 years to do that, you have 40 more years of emissions under your belts that just do not go away. The experiment is done. This is why they said there's no such thing as wait and see, because wait and see is wait and do. And that if you were serious, the only option, according to the laws of physics, is to find ways today to put online 10 to 20 trillion watts of carbon-free power within our lifetimes on our planet. Well, this is a big challenge, but also a big opportunity. As I like to tell people, I would like it if every smart scientist and engineer did nothing else but think about this problem 24 hours a day. Because if we don't cure cancer, you know, the world's going to stay the same. It may not be better, but it's going to stay the same in 20 more years. If we don't build the next computer chip, the world's going to be the same. If we don't solve this problem, then we can say, according to the laws of chemistry and physics, that the world is never going to be the same for a timescale comparable to modern human history. I did not say it would absolutely be bad. I did say we are going to be the only generation that will be in the position to do the biggest experiment that humans will have ever done. Well, if that doesn't make you feel good, warm, and fuzzy, then let's go back to the laws of physics and decide where the allowed solutions are. The only proven technology that we have that can scale to these levels is nuclear power. Now, I am personally not for or against nuclear fission, but I do think it's important to understand what we are voting for if we vote to do nothing else. We heard about nuclear power in the last presidential campaign where one side said, my policy is to build 46 new nuclear power plants. Sounds like a lot. I already told you we need at minimum 10 trillion watts, at minimum. And I also already told you that nuclear power plants are designed safely to be permitted to hold the neutrons and the heat in that scale of things to make a billion watts. Well, quick arithmetic says that you only need to build 10,000 nuclear power plants. Actually, that's just about one every single day, starting today, somewhere in the world for the next 40 straight years. And then, since they only last 40 years, you got to keep doing that forever. Okay? So all of a sudden, people start to think, maybe it's not so easy. It turns out there's more energy and natural gas on our planet than there is in U-235 used in once-throughs. Yes, you could get it from seawater, but you'd have to have the equivalent of 3,000 Niagara Falls as running in all the oceans of the world all the time. So you have to find ways to really increase the burn rate or make full fuel cycles with plutonium. You know, we should credit North Korea and Iran for stepping up to do their part to mitigate global warming, right? If you don't do massive quantities of nuclear power and even build only one reactor a week starting today for the next 40 years, you still leave 90% of the problem on the table. So where do you get the other 90%? Assuming you save energy down to twice what it takes to eat. Well, you can capture and store that carbon by still burning it in so-called clean coal, which is a good advertising slogan that exists on TV, but not yet in reality. The idea is you're going to bury the CO2 somewhere. You could put it in the oceans, but we're already acidifying the oceans, so that's mostly technically now been discredited. You could put it in the oil and gas fields, but there's only 30 years of capacity there globally. And don't be fooled, when you put CO2 down, you force oil back up, so the oil companies like this because they make more oil instead of the CO2 is the real economic driver. The only place to really put it is in the underground aquifer, in the underground brine. The good news is that when you put CO2 down into the aquifers, you make a lot of Perrier, and Perrier costs more per bottle per gallon than oil does today, so we could fix our balance of trade. The bad news is it can't leak. If 1% of this leaks globally for 100 years, then the net flux is the same as what you started with in the first place. Because the lifetime of CO2 in the air is 3,000 years, then we have to write environmental impact reports that will convince the public within the next 10 years that we can put massive quantities of carbon dioxide liquids below our soil. And trust me, it's not going to leak at 0.1% a year for 1,000 years. That recent leak we just had is going to make life pretty hard on people that want to tell the public that we can put lots of stuff down there for 1,000 years and trust me, it's never going to leak. Well, if you don't bury all your carbon and you don't build more than a nuclear reactor every week starting today, then you can only get the rest of it from renewable sources, of which there are six. Hydroelectricity is a model renewable energy source. It's cheap. It's pretty benign. Sure, when you do it in China, you only displace 1 million people. Every energy source has its problems. We have Cape Wind here. Nobody likes that, except all the people that want the energy from it. The problem with hydroelectricity is it's all done already. If you add up the kinetic energy and potential energy of all the rivers, lakes, and streams on our planet, it's only worth 4.5 terawatts. But you can't dam up the Okefenokee Swamp and really get much out of it. So where you can technically do hydroelectricity is only 1.5 terawatts. You could technically dam up the Hudson River, but the Yankees would have to find yet another place to play. And fortunately, we're in Boston, and we know that's a good thing, so we won't complain, but maybe the Yankees would complain. So where you can economically do it is 0.9 terawatts, and we've already installed 0.6. There's no room to grow. This is the virtue of putting everything in a common unit because you can see where the problems and solutions really lie. The mean flux at the surface of all geothermal energy on the Earth can be looked up in any textbook because we know the temperature of the core, we know the temperature of the surface, and we know the thermal conductivity of the Earth. That flux is worth 57 milliwatts per square meter. So let's forget about the second law of thermodynamics. We'll dispense with that little pest. And we'll assume we get 100% efficient heat engines covering all land on Earth. You get 11 terawatts. There's more if you mine it, but then you're mining it and running out of the resource. And we can talk more about the economics of drilling down 5 kilometers to pull out steam at 1/100 the energy density of pulling out oil and how much that would really cost. And that's about all you need to know about geothermal. The wind blows a lot more in Washington, D.C. than it does on our planet. You'll hear about skyrocketing estimates, but I'll tell you the flaw with them. It's true that people make point source estimates of the wind at each location, and then they add them all up and claim how much wind energy there is. But if you're a windsurfer like me, and you know when you get behind a sailboat, what happens is you run out of wind. And the same thing happens with wind turbines. It would be great if 100 kilometers downstream of a whole bunch of windmills, you had the same energy as if none of the other windmills were there. But it doesn't work that way. And best estimates show that you have a few terawatts of wind to be had in all the high wind speed land areas on our planet. Wind is the fastest growing renewable, and we should do it where we can and where it makes sense. But don't be under the impression that we're going to get the needed energy to solve this gap mostly from that. Here's a 20 terawatt line on a log scale. Here's all the energy and all the ocean currents and all the tides and all the waves on our planet combined. It isn't close. Not even close. Here are the best estimates of what you could do with biomass if you took half of all the land on Earth where you could grow crops, and you grew the fastest known growing crops there, and you assumed 100% yield and no energy into the farm and no energy needed to go get it out. Get it all. You might get 7 terawatts. Now, in actuality, best estimates now are you'll probably get a terawatt because we care about carbon in this environment. And in this problem, when you till the soil has twice as much carbon in it in a square meter as all the carbon in all the atmosphere above it. You release all that carbon, the very carbon you didn't want to release in the first place. And so it takes you between 40 and 400 years to pay back your debt of carbon by substituting biofuels for fossil fuels. In fact, for 40 years, you would have been better burning gasoline than you were converting that land for food into fuel. And furthermore, when somebody converts food into fuel, somebody else needs to chop down some more stuff and grow some more food, and so they incur another carbon debt. And so best estimates are you might make a terawatt this way of equivalent offset. Now, this is a really important terawatt because it does, in principle, make liquid transportation fuels, which could be really valuable because it turns out 40% of global transportation is heavy-duty ships, trucks, and airplanes. And last time I looked, nobody had yet invented a plug-in hybrid airplane. It is completely foolish to waste our precious biofuel potential resources on light-duty vehicles with yellow caps. But that's just energy policy. If you cared, last year, 30% of corn in the United States was used to provide 2% of our transportation fuel. But that didn't stop Congress from passing a law saying that within 10 years we have to do 5 times more than that. Quick math tells you the difference between a law of politics and a law of physics, because only the former can be repealed. Well, plants actually are very inefficient energy conversion machines. Less than 1% of the incident energy that hits a square meter in the fastest growing plant gets stored. But they did figure out where the energy really is, because the solar constant gives us not 10 terawatts, but 120,000 terawatts. More energy from the sun hits the Earth in 1 hour than all the energy consumed on our planet in an entire year. Nothing else comes close. More energy from the sun is going to hit the Earth in 1 year than all the energy consumed in human history, and that statement's going to be just as true in 100 years from today as it is today. So I've already told you 2 big cards: nuclear power and potentially cleaning up fossil energy by sequestering the carbon essentially permanently, and the third big card that nature gives us by far is the sun. There is no denying these fundamental physical properties of the solar system in which we live. Rick Smalley used to say, when he and I would go around the country, that he thought the answer was always nuclear fusion. But it was a pretty good idea to stay not too close to that fusion reactor, and 93 million miles sounded just about right. Photosynthesis on our planet today gives us 90 terawatts, and we only need 10 more. We can't have that 10 because it's in detailed balance with respiration. Here's a map. This is a famous map of mine. It appeared off my website on the TV show The West Wing. They spent an hour talking about energy, and just in real life, the program ended and they did nothing. Nevertheless, this shows you need about, a healthy chunk of Kansas. And if you had a 10% efficient set of systems over that land area, you could provide not just the United States' electricity, but its energy forever. Now, there's a few good things about this. Number one is, even though it's not a small area, it's equivalent to our nation's numbered highway systems. Everything with a number, Mass Ave, MEM Drive, would be equivalent to this land area covered. The good news is this little county in Texas would make so much money, and in Kansas, they make so much money they could be their own state member of OPEC, right? The other good news is I've been giving this talk now for the better part of 7 years to over 150,000 people live, and I still have never met anybody that actually lived there. Let me test this audience. No, nobody. There's nothing on Google Earth there. There are no votes there. We'll never miss it. You would never do it this way, of course. Now, to be fair, if you had to build a nuclear power plant every day, then you have to put up the equivalent if you don't do that. You have to put up 1 million solar roofs every single day, starting today, to stay on pace. I claim you cannot do this as long as we have solar panels that are like glass museum pieces. We talk about clean jobs, but we would need the Army times 100 doing nothing but that with the technology we have now if this was the job you wanted to fulfill. In fact, because solar cells are like 10 or 15% efficient, but cost on the panels now $300 a square meter and another $300 equivalent to get the people to install them and hook up the inverters and the balance of systems. And you know the energy of the sun, we hope, isn't going to change in the next 30 years. If you get 10% of it, I can do quick math and say how much product energy I can give you from a square meter. And then I can figure out how much I have to charge you just to make back what I invested in the first place with no cost of money. And that number comes out to about 20 cents a kilowatt hour. So electricity cost from coal is much less than that, and fossil energy home heating is much less than that. You cannot get there just by improving the efficiency. You have to really lower the cost, including storage, down to under $100 a square meter and probably more like 10 or 30. To give you a feeling for what that is, the cost of paint at Home Depot is $1 a square meter. The cost of that carpet is $10 a square meter. The stuff has to be like carpet that we can all go buy at Home Depot and roll it out at home and be done. There are ways to think about this. Instead of making expensive single crystals, we should be using little particles and finding ways to fool these particles and having electrons hop from particle to particle instead of seeing that the atoms at the surface aren't bonded like those in the bulk in what we lovingly call solar paint. These exist in the lab at small scale, but not as efficient or as scalable as we'd like them yet. This is a challenge for the scientific community to actually bring this to reality. You can think about doing it with nanotechnology, making little photon forests of nanowires. There's a lot of creativity involved in this fermenting up, but we have to continue to foster that because we have a gap. We do not have all the technology we need if scale is the challenge in this problem, even if you can do it on a rooftop or a parking lot that's not doing it over half of Kansas. And even if we put solar cells and solar panels over that entire area, I claim we wouldn't have done much. Because the sun has this nasty little habit, goes out locally every single night. And he that cannot store will not have power after 4. Oh, you guys are probably too old to know about Johnny Cochran, but if he were given this talk, that would have been the slogan. These are all my pop culture references. plants solve the problem. They store that energy in chemical bonds, the most energy-dense way to store energy other than the nucleus that we know of. We wouldn't care about plants if they didn't store sunlight. They're really rotten. They'd get an F for energy efficiency conversion in a design class. If I gave your design class the task to make a machine that converted sunlight into something useful and they said, oh, good, I'm done, less than 1% of it I use, you would have said, what about the 99% they waste? But they store it in chemical fuel. Solar cells don't. They make electricity. There is no good way to store massive quantities of electricity. If you have one, you should buy electricity tonight from the local power plant for 5 cents a kilowatt hour. You should sell it to everybody tomorrow during peak for 25 cents a kilowatt hour. And you should remember to fund BU with all the proceeds that you make, because the endowment would grow by $1 billion a day if you did that. Batteries, the most energy-dense battery is 200 watt-hours per kilogram. The energy density in gasoline is 13,000 watt-hours per kilogram. You don't need to know anything more to know why it's so hard to get range out of electric cars. It's a law of physics, not a law of engineering. If you want to pump electricity, energy uphill to store electricity now, the cheapest way is pump water uphill. You want to store the energy in 1 gallon of gasoline, you have to pump 55,000 gallons of water up the height of Hoover Dam. Okay? There's not enough water, there's not enough scale. What works in your backyard does not work on the scale of a country or our planet. So I think you can make a compelling case that probably we are going to have to find a way to store massive quantities of energy in chemical bonds. After all, that's where it's stored now, in all the bonds of oil, coal, and gas. People say the grid has no storage. The grid has infinite storage because we burn coal and methane only when we need it from all that stored energy that we then harness on demand on the flick of that switch. So I think we need to find a way to directly make chemical fuel from the sun. Plants know how to do that. But they're very inefficient. They were not designed to be energy conversion machines. They were designed to reproduce and to look pretty and to do lots of other things. 30% of the energy in a plant is used just to repair the D1 enzyme that makes oxygen that makes the plant live. At universities, we call this overhead. All right? People say we'll do this with solar thermal technology like this, that'll dual-axis focus the rays of the sun onto this poor little Stirling engine, and then it makes electricity that goes through this electrolysis unit, and every day this plus this fills up that tank with hydrogen. And you'd only have to install one of these every second for the next 50 straight years if you wanted to meet the goal. This is the difference between a demonstration and something that can actually make trillions of watts in the 40 years minus 9 months that we have left. Okay. The other thing that we need to discover is this electrolysis unit probably has about half the world's supply of platinum in it. And when the amount of platinum needed to power a school bus based on fuel cells costs $500,000, like it does today, we will have a vigorous hydrogen economy consisting of stolen school buses. The driver is going to be the most dangerous job on earth, right? We know plants know how to do this. We know plants and bacteria don't use platinum, they use iron. We know they're not poisoned by carbon monoxide and sulfur. They actually have it in the molecule's active site. They need it for function. We just don't yet know how to do that ourselves. So there's a challenge for material scientists and chemists to figure out what biology knew how to do. And now that we recently know the structure of hydrogenases and nature's catalysts, our job should be easier because we should be able to just look at it, learn the principles, and then make it ourselves. The same thing for oxygen. It's true that the oxygen in our atmosphere all came from photosynthesis, from manganese, not from platinum or ruthenium. It's also true it doesn't last very long, but we do have a design principle. The most active catalysts that are man-made are ruthenium and iridium. They're far too rare to be used in real systems. and the most active non-noble metal catalysts still pale in their activity compared to what is needed and what biology shows us we can do. And so we still need to make enormous strides to develop the science to let this happen. So we need a lot of energy. And if you don't want to roll the dice, it better be low carbon. You've got to conserve energy like your lives depended on it, because they probably ultimately do. But don't be fooled. No amount of saving energy ever turned on a light bulb. No amount of saving energy ever put food on somebody's table. You still have to make enormous amounts of clean energy within our lifetimes. And you'd better get it from either coal or nuclear or cheap solar fuel or some combination, starting essentially today. This is not somebody else's problem. This is not a problem you can say, let's solve later and actually solve it. This is a problem that we either decide we can't afford to do, or that we simply can't afford to fail. That decision is something that we make every time we vote. It's something we make every time we flip on a light switch, and every time we decide what area of science and technology we're going to go into in the one shot that we have to fix it. So with that, I'm sure we can do it. We have no fundamental physical principles that say we can't develop this technology, that we can't make it cost-effective and affordable and globally scalable. We just have to decide that this is really important and is something that we can't afford to wait.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by California Institute of Technology professor Dr. Nathan Lewis. Dr. Lewis's lecture was titled, Where in the World Will Our Energy Come From? And was presented by the Boston University Clean Energy and Environmental Sustainability Initiative. He was introduced by Ken Luchin, Dean of the Boston University College of Engineering. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liambruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.